are listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Philip Gurevich, editor of the Paris Review, here today for Leonard LoPate. Joseph O'Neill's new novel, Netherland, has received pretty universal acclaim. In The New Yorker, James Wood called it a large fictional achievement. It's the story of a Dutchman living in post 9/11 New York, who, after his wife and son have left him to return to London, becomes immersed in the game of cricket and the immigrant subculture that surrounds it. It's also the story of his friendship with a Trinidadian immigrant who dreams of making cricket popular on a mass scale to Americans and through Americans and from America to the world at large, a great immigrant hustler character. The narrative and themes have led some to invite comparisons to a variety of books, including The Great Gatsby and some of Saul Bellow's novels. Netherland is published by Pantheon, and it's my great pleasure. It's brought Joseph O'Neill to the Leonard LoPate Show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Tell me, the novel is often described as a post-9/11 novel, a 9/11 novel, since the plot, I suppose, and the story of the characters gets set in motion in part by the moves that they undergo after 9/11. Do you think of it as a 9/11 novel? Do you think of that as framing the world it's in?
Well, when I was writing it, I never thought of it as a 9/11 novel. I wasn't even really aware that there existed such a thing. But then when I sort of emerged from the slightly subterranean world of the act of writing and then into the life, people started talking about this 9/11 novel phenomenon. And then I only then became aware that this was a genre which had apparently come into being over the last few years. Actually, this book, when I conceived of the main idea of this book, which is to write about this city, bringing in this marginal cricket world, that happened before 9/11, and then before I could actually write very much about that, 9/11 happened. And then in due course, I think it became inevitable if I was going to describe the city that I would have to describe it as it had been changed. And so in that sense, it is a 9/11 novel, but at no point did I, set out to write the 9/11 novel.
Yeah, it seems like the events are in the background in a certain way, and that even when people refer to them, they're often using them, as it were, as a bit of an excuse or an explanation for things that are taking their course in their lives, whether it's the course of the marriage or the course of various business schemes or so, that might have been underway anyway, and that somehow 9/11 becomes this. You talk even at one point about the euphoria that many people in the city felt, and around the country felt, at the sense of community that it created, a sense of energy, a sense that things were changing.
I think that's right. I think there was a euphoric element. I'm speaking from my own observation of New York City at that time and America generally. But I think there are darker aspects to the euphoria, other than the sense of community and collective effort, which obviously happened after 9/11. I think that there is something energizing, whether you like it or not, about being party to, or at least the witness of, a terrible tragedy. And I think it's probably an evolutionary thing. Your first reaction is to effectively deal with a surge of adrenaline, and that can lead in all sorts of directions, as we've discovered.
Now, like your character, your narrator, Hans van den Broek, you spent much of your childhood in The Hague in the Netherlands, but you're actually from an Irish family, an Irish-Turkish family. How long have you been living in New York?
I came to New York in 1998, and before then I'd been living in London since I'd left university, and I was working as a lawyer in London.
And as a novelist.
And as a novelist, yeah. I combined the two over there.
And when did you start playing cricket in New York?
Well, I arrived in May 98, and that's the beginning of the cricket season as far as I'm concerned. So I immediately started looking around, and of course there wasn't any cricket to be seen. And then I looked in the Yellow Pages, and I spoke to a Pakistani man who identified himself as the president of the World Cricket League, and an institution I've never heard of. And he put me in touch with an Australian, who then put me in touch with a Tobagan. And then before I knew it, I was playing cricket.
I'm Philip Gurevich. I'm here today for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org, and my guest is Joseph O'Neill, the novelist, and we're speaking about his new book, Netherland. You say you started playing cricket. You started playing in Staten Island. Is that where you began?
And Yeah, I started playing in Staten Island. It turns out, although you wouldn't guess it if you visited the ground, that Staten Island Cricket Club is probably the oldest. It's certainly the oldest continuously existing. I was going to say flourishing, but I think that's overstating it. Existing cricket club in New York City, and indeed in the United States. But I think it's probably one of the oldest sports clubs of any kind in this city. It's now, you know, it's now a club for immigrants of various kinds, 99% of whom are from Asia or the West Indies. And somehow or other, we you know, year after year, we managed to put teams together. And we'll be celebrating 125 years at Walker Park, which is our home ground, next year. So we're sort of looking forward to that.
It's one of the striking things is that you're describing the game of cricket as a foreign game to the United States, and at the same time it becomes this vehicle for describing an American immigration and a chapter of American immigration that really hasn't had much of a place in American literature before. Am I right? I mean, are you aware of other novels that deal with what might be called the West Indian and East Asian diaspora in the same way as such a vital part of New York City?
I'm sure there are. There must be something there. I know Jhumpa Lahiri deals with some East Asian or South Asian, however you want to call it, immigrants. But it's true that there is a very particular demographic which has occurred in the last 20 years, last 30 years. I mean, the West Indians have been coming to New York City, I think, for longer than that. But certainly the Guyanese and the Trinidadians have been pouring in since the 1970s in significant numbers. And then we've had this kind of wonderful surge of people from India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. And they are actually bringing with them this obsession with cricket. And so you now have, you know, for the first time, probably since the 1870s or 1880s, a very flourishing, you know, if deeply marginal and invisible cricket playing scene here in New York City.
One of the things that struck me in reading the way that you brought all of these elements together is that here you do have this post 9/11 moment, this character whose life is thrown into turmoil as his wife sets out back for London, the narrator, Hans, and he enters the cricket world. And We're used to being told that after 9/11, the world and America grew further and further apart after its initial moment of sympathetic solidarity, and that particularly much of the decolonized world felt more hostile to America as imperialist. And yet what you have here are the people of the former British Empire converging on New York, creating a new vibrancy to the city that captivates this Dutch immigrant himself. And the only anti-imperialist thing that gets said in the book, as far as I can tell, is comes from the British wife back in the mothership of empire in London complaining about America. But that's not how these immigrants are seeing it at all.
No, I mean, you know, there is, I mean, these, you know, like a lot of immigrant groups, they're not very politicized, wherever they're from. I don't think they feel sufficiently secure in the host culture to be very political and to be very demanding. But it is the secret project of Hans's great buddy, this guy Chuck Rampersoon, to use cricket as this kind of countercultural, counter-American vehicle in order to expand the national consciousness. I mean, it turns out that so that he's not, in his own mind at least, not merely trying to establish or re-establish a game which he regards as a Native American game. He's actually trying to expand, you know, expand what he would regard as a rather narrow American vision of the world, on the grounds that if they can be brought to understand cricket and to see cricket, then that's a very good way of making America maybe see more than it's currently seeing, able to see.
I'm Philip Gurevich. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Joseph O'Neill, author of the new novel Netherland, published by Pantheon. We have to take a quick break now. Stay tuned. I'm Philip Gurevich here today for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking to Joseph O'Neill, author of Netherland, the new novel. And you just mentioned the character Chuck Ramkassoon, who really is the other central character. There's the narrator and his story, and there's the story of Chuck Ramkassoon, and who says at one point, you were talking about the way he sees cricket as almost a way of subverting aspects of the American immigrant story. You want a taste of how it feels to be a black man in this country? Put on the white clothes of the cricketers. Put on white to feel black. Why do you think cricket never really caught on in this country, and what does he really mean by that?
Well, in answer to the first question, that's a deeply sort of controversial subject. You know, the traditional view is that cricket, which was actually, I think as Chuck points out in the book somewhere, a favorite sport of Benjamin Franklin's, cricket was played in the United States and was played very seriously. I think it was the first organized team sport here in the 1840s. And the traditional theory is that it's too time-consuming a game, and plus it had various colonial overtones, and that when baseball came along, it was simply kind of defeated by the superior and more American game. The one exception to that was Philadelphia, where they had these amazing cricket clubs, which still exist, and which, although the fields are now used for lawn tennis, they still host cricket matches from time to time. And what was your saying?
When you say put on the white, when he says put on the white clothes of the cricketers, put on white to feel black.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's because, you know, that's a sort of, in my mind, that's a reference to Ralph Ellison, you know, his obviously Invisible Man, which was all about the invisibility of black Americans in the mainstream, to the mainstream eye. And Chuck, who's something of a political opportunist rather than a convinced ideologue, is aware of this kind of tradition of invisibility in this country, and that he is part of this tradition. And so in order to, after a game, in order to excite the emotions of his 99.9% black audience, mm-hmm. He gives a speech, and he sort of essentially asserts that if you're on a black-skinned American and you want to double up on your blackness, you should then paradoxically wear white.
And throughout the book, the book gets seen as this book of cricket just as much as it gets seen as a 9/11 novel, and yet there's a side to it which it seems to me is a very passionate, almost love letter to something about American energy, to America as a place that connects to a lot of old ideas of the American dream, and it goes back through and touches on the one hand, the history of Dutch settlement in the Hudson Valley, the choice of the bald eagle as the American national bird, the ideas of immigrant change and transformation, and something liberating for somebody who comes from the old world to this original post-colonial country. And I wonder how you felt that was sort of – there's a lot of it that's almost sketch work where you just describe the city, the vibrancy of the city. The narrator lives in the Chelsea Hotel. They're wonderful set pieces where just the colorful characters that one encounters moving through the city as a stroller.
Mm. Well, I mean, the novel starts with Hans in London, and he hears about the death of his friend Chuck, who's been drowned and his body has been found in the Gowanus Canal, which is a very American outcome to a life. And this makes him, this is 2006, and he remembers 2003, which is the year essentially that their friendship took place. And so what happens is that in mourning for his friend, the act of mourning triggers an intense act of mourning for New York City itself and for the promises which he understood it to be holding out at that when he arrived in that city. And so it's an intense spasm of recollection and I think that when you're in an almost nostalgic but certainly reminiscent frame of mind, you do kind of wallow rather happily in the memories of the city at its most kind of vibrant. And in fact, I actually find in my observation that New Yorkers, you don't have to leave New York to do that. New Yorkers walk around in a state of complete kind of amazement and gratitude for the city in where they live. And Hans has that even though he's left the city.
By contrast, you present London as a place where people go to dinner parties and talk about their foreign vacations.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
You know, I don't know. Hans talks about it in those terms. I mean,
I'm sorry.
Yes. I wouldn't know. I mean, that's for Hans to say. No, I mean, I you know, it's true. I came from London, and I have to say that when I came to New York, I was rather taken aback when I came to New York by this sheer kind of sense of collaboration that existed here. You know, you told people that you were a writer, and they immediately said, "Oh, what books have you written? Can I? Oh, you must meet so and so." Whereas in London, you know, if you told anyone you were a writer or you divulged any kind of personal project, you know, even if they were able to, they would quickly change the subject and then make it their business to foil you behind your back. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but you don't have. I mean, New York is a wonderfully collaborative and encouraging city. For practically everybody.
I'm Philip Gurevich. I'm in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Joseph O'Neill, author of Netherland, just published this spring by Pantheon. The writing is very rich. Beautifully crafted. The sentences are often remarked upon. The choice of words. There seems a great care here, and at the same time, a kind of colloquial ease. And you seem to delight. And here I assume it's you, the writer, rather than merely your narrator, in doing the voices of the different immigrants, of the different characters, of the different levels of street speech in New York. Mm. How long did you work on this book, and how much rewriting and sort of reporting, in a sense, went into it?
Well, I mean, I worked on this book for far too long, is the answer. It was 7 years, and it was a period of, and that's a long period of time when you don't have the comfort of a book contract to sustain you. You know, I had conceived of the book in pretty general terms almost pretty quickly. But it was actually I now understand why it took 7 years, because to get that kind of richness of detail, which I was hoping to get, it really does help to kind of observe these various communities which I describe year after year. I mean, and it turns out, although I wasn't aware of it at the time, I thought I was just, you know, playing cricket. It turns out that I was actually conducting a kind of, you know, a long-running kind of journalistic penetration of a community which very few kind of writers would have access to.
Your first two novels, written in the early 90s, were both comic novels, and largely. And then you took a break between novels before Netherland and wrote a memoir of your grandfathers, in large part, your family, and both of whom were imprisoned as Nazi collaborators, essentially, during World War II, but one of whom was really very deeply, in one side of your family, deeply involved in the IRA and so forth. A much more serious and political book, and it seems like in this book these two threads come together, both the research instinct, the investigative instinct, but also the gravity of history intersecting with a kind of comic touch about day-to-day life. Does that seem?
Yeah, I mean, I'm grateful for that description. I actually think of my last book, which was published in 2001, as my 9/11 book, even though it was written before 9/11.
Oh, it's a terrorist at the core of it.
Yeah, it's about these two grandfathers who are both imprisoned. One a suspected Nazi, the other a suspected IRA man, and it turns, as I sort of write it, into an examination of what it means to develop a political conscience. And the book kind of ends with essentially a kind of warning to myself as much as to anybody else that although we've lived in very quiet and peaceful times, unlike my grandfather's, you know, the question of our political consciences will be tested before long. And sure enough, they were. And of course, you know, and we in this book, we have a narrator, a Dutchman, who has almost no political conscience, who's not really capable of analyzing the world around him in political terms, even at the end of the book.
Well, I mean, he actually describes himself at one point as a political ethical idiot, though it seems that when he does that, he's in part suggesting that a lot of the people around him may be more idiotic for their certainties than he is for his inability to really make any judgments politically or ethically. Is that?
I think he's slightly in awe of everyone, of the kind of level of certainty surrounding him. And we now know, of course, that the more certain anybody was about what to do in the wake of 9/11, the more wrong they almost certainly were. I think there's a larger issue here, which is the issue of, you know, how do we make a conscientious statement about the world? and you have a man who whose job is, he's an oil analyst, and it's his job to come up with these opinions, none of which he really believes in, but which are lucrative for him and which kind of work and are plausible in the business world. But I think he has a real... The entire novel is spent with this man trying to gain some kind of perspective on almost every aspect of his life. I mean, he's always looking out of windows, he's always zooming in on things and pulling back, and he's trying to see things, trying to see the world around him. And in a way, it's a kind of reflection. It's almost as if America is involved after 9/11 in this kind of effort to see the world as clearly as possible.
Well, there are two settings in the novel that seem to stand out. One is the Chelsea Hotel, where he has taken refuge after 9/11, where I gather you actually reside.
I do.
And and it's a cast of characters, and it's neighborhood and its milieu, but also what at one point Hans, the narrator, describes, well, in the world words of Chuck, as the real Brooklyn, which is an immigrant Brooklyn, a Brooklyn on the other side of Prospect Park, out Flatbush towards Coney Island. And if I may just read a paragraph at one point, he describes going with Chuck Ramkissoon, this is the narrator who lives at the Chelsea Hotel, saying, "We traveled the length of Coney Island Avenue, that low-slung, scruffily commercial thoroughfare that stands in almost surreal contrast to the tranquil residential blocks it traverses. A shoddily bustling strip of vehicles double-parked in front of gas stations, synagogues, mosques, beauty salons, bank branches, restaurants, funeral homes, auto body shops, supermarkets, assorted small businesses proclaiming provenances from Pakistan, Tajikistan, Ethiopia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Armenia, Ghana, the Jewry, Christendom, Islam. It was on Coney Island Avenue on a subsequent occasion that Chuck and I came upon a bunch of South African Jews in full sectarian regalia watching televised cricket with a couple of Rastafarians in the front office of a Pakistani-run lumberyard." That's a great sentence. That is, by the way, for listeners who can't see the punctuation, one sentence and it works. But it also packs it in, I think, at sentences like that, both for the specificity of their language and for their energy that get the comparisons to Bellows immigrant sort of bustle and energy, I suppose. And else. But I was reminded of people more like Whitman. I mean, there's a kind of celebration of just the sheer throng.
Yeah. Well, there is an epigraph, if that's what you call that little quote at the front of a book, from Whitman.
That's true.
Which is rather eerie. I'm amazed that, you know, I keep waiting to... I had this little epigraph in mind, and I kept waiting to read about it somewhere, because it's all about New York City, dreaming of New York City. I wonder if you could read it.
"I dreamed in a dream I saw a city invincible to the attacks of the whole of the rest of the earth. I dreamed that was the new city of friends."
I mean, it's eerie.
It's from Leaves of Grass, I assume?
No, actually, it's not. It's not from Leaves of Grass. Uh-huh. Actually, it is from Leaves of Grass. I beg your pardon. Mm-hmm. It is from Leaves of Grass. Though I can't actually... I'll have to go back to the book and find it again.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. We are... in describing this Brooklyn, I was essentially describing, you know, what continues to be this current of energy in New York life and in American life, which is the stream of immigrants, and which continues to this day, notwithstanding the sort of larger gloom that seems to have settled on the country.
And do you feel that the American dream that you're describing in these immigrants, and particularly in Chuck Ramkissoon, who, as you say, meets this American end in handcuffs underwater, undiscovered mm-hmm. in the bottom of the Gowanus Canal, not a great American end compared to the Greenwood Cemetery that he also visits and celebrates. Do you think that this American dream that you're describing is the same or deeply divergent from the American dream that is the dream in Gatsby, that is the dream in Whitman, that is the dream?
Yeah.
That those are the same. But.
Yes, no, but my own thought about that is that that the American dream as it's classically conceived, not just in literature but also in political culture, you know, we hear our candidates talking about, you know, everyone should have an opportunity to have their piece of the American dream. I think the old premise is that America is this privileged zone which offers exclusive opportunities. You have to come here to take advantage of the American dream. Well, I don't think that's true anymore, and I think there's a moment in the book where I explore this. I think that with just in the last 10 years, we've seen such globalization of money, such a globalization of information, that you can the ideas of the geographic specialness and economic specialness of America is just not there as it used to be. So I think that we are there is an American dream of sorts there, but I think we have to think more carefully about whether or not our old notions of it are still current.
The book has, I suppose, for lack of to resort to a phrase that's a bit outdated these days, it has a bit of the ambition of a great American novel. It's not a sprawling book in terms of length. It's 250 some pages. Mm-hmm. It is not sprawling in terms of generations or time in the same way, and yet it really does take on these very large themes, very complexly integrated, and obviously, as reviews have suggested, it's one that's struck a chord. You were not a writer well known in this country beforehand by comparison. Do you think it helps, in your case at least, that you've come here as an adult from the outside to be able to see this complex, fragmented, fractious America whole, and that those of us who are here are often blinded to a great deal of what we're living in?
Well, first of all, you know, there's very gracious terms in which you've described the book. I'm not sure. I think there are definite advantages in being someone who's an insider and an outsider, and I think that there are imaginative resources that I have, which simply by virtue of my having come from Europe and having had different sorts of experiences. But on the other hand, you know, there are lots of American native-born American writers who have their own advantages and their own resources. And, I would be the last person to suggest that what I've written is somehow beyond anyone who's been brought up here. It's different, and it has a novelty value for that reason.
It ends with I don't think it says so in the beginning, so I'm not giving anything away here as a spoiler. Mm-hmm. I don't think, but it does end with the narrator returning to England into a kind of domesticity and withdrawing in many ways from his immersion in this world. I gather that in the non-fictional world, in reality, is it true that you're in the process of becoming an American citizen?
I have, and I'm not only I am a fully fledged American citizen. I'll have you know, Philip.
Well, good news for all of us.
And I'm voting, and I'm sort of voting like crazy. And it's great. It's great. And I sort of feel, I feel quite excited about it.
Well, so I'm Philip Gravage, and I've been speaking to the American novelist Joseph O'Neill about his first American novel, Netherland, just published by Pantheon. I'm in today for Leonard Lopate. Thanks so much for being with us, Bill.
Thank you, Philip.